It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas discusses the future of the private option in the state with political columnist John Brummett. Also, Minnesota-based Summit Brewing Company will introduce some of its craft beers to the state next week.
Plus, in the latest installment of our monthly Three People series, we talked to three coaches about their careers. Those stories and more. But first, a new report from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics ranks the Northwest Arkansas region as the fourth in job growth for 2013. The report, released yesterday afternoon, says the Fayetteville-Springdale-Rogers region has added about 9,000 new jobs last year. Kathy Deck, director of the University of Arkansas Center for Business and Economic Research, says the growth was spread out among many sectors.
The growth that we had over the past year was that it was so very, very broad-based. In fact, we didn't have a single sector of our economy that declined in terms of employment year over year. The information sector was flat, but everybody else, from the manufacturers all the way up to our professional and business services and trade, transportation, and utilities, all of our other job-creating sectors showed growth.
The report places Northwest Arkansas's non-farm job growth for 2013 at better than 4.5%, behind only two cities in Texas, Midland and Odessa, and Winchester, Virginia. Northwest Arkansas was previously ranked as high as fourth in job growth in 2001. Deck says the growth of the last year can spill into 2014.
2013 sets 2014 up for success. As we look at the United States, the United States economy really has been muddling through. It just hasn't been growing as quickly as we would hope. But Northwest Arkansas can handle a situation like that. Northwest Arkansas it can, in fact, thrive from an economic development perspective, even when the United States is just muddling through. Our industrial mix is set up that we're going to continue to grow.
One other Arkansas city, Jonesboro, ranked on the 2013 list. It was ranked as 11th in job growth. We'll have more on this report later on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
The latest sales tax revenue numbers for cities in Northwest Arkansas show a cumulative increase. According to thecitywire.com, the four biggest cities collectively brought in more than $4.2 million in November. Rogers sales tax collections of nearly $1.25 million represents an increase of 14% when compared to a year ago. Each of the four cities is reporting an increase in sales tax collections for 2013 when compared to tax revenues of 2012.
Northwest Arkansas Community College will soon add 10 more acres to its campus after the college's board voted to buy a strip of land from the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad. The land bisects the Bentonville campus, and Stephen Hines, the college's public relations director, says purchasing the strip of 9.47 acres for $2.5 million will allow the college to take control of its campus.
Right now we have no control over that railroad property or what might be occurring on the rail line there, what might be stored, what could be in those cars. We also are greatly concerned about the safety of our students who may be crossing on or around or through those cars. And we believe that it is something that will benefit the students because it's safer in terms of literally as they're crossing over, say, going to our Center for Health Professions or our Global Business. Also, the fact that we will know that there is no longer the potential for hazardous materials to be stored in the cars.
As part of the deal, the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad agrees to dismantle the rail spur on the land and fill the holes left by the tracks, giving students an easier walk across campus. Although the strip of land will be the smallest acreage bought for the highest price of any previous land purchases by the college, Hines says that NWAC is still getting a good deal overall.
We did look at the average cost per acre to which the college has bought land since it began, and even at this price of the $2.5 million, the college will be paying approximately $32,000 an acre for all land that is acquired, which is a third of the appraised value. So we still believe the college is getting a significant return for its money when you look at it in terms of what it costs per acre, the appraised value.
Because some of the land the college is acquiring from the railroad will otherwise extend beyond the current bounds of the campus, NWAC officials also have the option of selling some of the unused land once the deal is finalized.
Once again, the Princeton Review is ranking the University of Arkansas as one of the 75 public university values. The 2014 list of the best 75 public and the best 75 private school values is based on 30 separate factors, including tuition costs, academic reputation, and financial aid availability. The University of Arkansas was the only school from the state on the list.
Arkansas's newest state senator is now an official member of the legislature. John Cooper was sworn in yesterday in Little Rock. Senator Cooper, a Republican, was elected to represent Craighead County in Jonesboro after former Senator Paul Bookout resigned because of ethics violations. Senator Cooper says he plans to vote to not continue funding for the private option to expand Medicaid.
I can't foresee supporting it. I ran on not supporting it, and I received 57% of the vote, and that was the major issue. So I think the voters have spoken in my district on that, and what they said was what I believe.
The expansion, called the private option, passed with just a vote to spare in the last session and was supported by former Senator Bookout. Another senator, Missy Irvin, has said she plans to switch her vote of support for the private option to vote against it. The fiscal session of the state legislature opens early next month.
A teaching farm is a step closer to fruition after a $20,000 donation to the effort last night. Ozark Natural Foods made the gift to Apple Seeds, the organization creating the farm. Mary Thompson, the co-executive director of Apple Seeds, says the farm will be designed for school field trips.
It will be a location for the whole region, a resource in which students can come on field trips as a learning experience. We can host workshops to help spread our programs to other schools in the region, so it will be a resource for the whole region.
Thompson says the $20,000 will allow Apple Seeds to establish gardens, install irrigation, and hire an on-site farm manager. She says she hopes the garden can have schools from Washington and Benton counties visit during the 2014-2015 academic year. The teaching farm will be located on land adjacent to Ozark Natural Foods in Fayetteville.
City officials in Bentonville say recent calls to residents about delinquent utility bills are a scam. The Bentonville Police Department says it has received several inquiries about calls attempting to have residents pay for delinquent accounts for the repair of broken meters over the phone. Officials say city utilities do require payments on a prepaid credit card. Questions about utility accounts should be directed toward the city by calling 271-3100.
The Razorback baseball team will begin the 2014 season ranked 25th in the nation. The first Baseball America poll was released this week and included eight SEC teams. Arkansas opens the season February 14th at home against Appalachian State.
Forecast calls for clear conditions tonight, with overnight lows around 23 for the region. Wind chill values in northwest Arkansas between 9 degrees and 19 degrees. Tomorrow, warming up to sunny skies with highs near 50. Mostly cloudy Thursday evening with overnight lows from 34 to 38.
This is Ozarks at Large. John Brummett is a columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. You can explore his political logic 4 days a week in print and online, and much more often on Twitter. Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas sat down with Brummett to discuss the upcoming legislative session, as well as the private option and its chances for survival in the upcoming fiscal session.
I want to pull a quote up here of something that you wrote in one of your columns earlier this week, because I love it when you put this type of language in here. It says, "Sigh. It's difficult to engage in constructive policy discussions when facts are mutilated to such an extent by those presenting to make policy."
Oh, my goodness.
John Brummett on January 22nd there. What are you frustrated about?
Well, in that case, I was frustrated with Senator Bart Hester from Northwest Arkansas, who had said in an email exchange with a constituent that the private option was just a ripoff at able-bodied people for able-bodied people who could work, as if everybody who got a job could get a full-time job that would pay for health insurance. And he's one of the absolute no's. That was sort of peripheral to the big discussion that you mentioned, which is the private option. Where is it? And I'll begin by saying this. Here's what most people say. It is too vital to the state's budget. It's too vital to the state's health care infrastructure for it not to get appropriated. But I don't know quite how we're going to get it done. That's sort of what people are saying. It's just surely it's going to happen, but we don't know how it's going to get done. We're one vote short in the Senate. The Jonesboro Senate race was about this issue, and it went the way of no private option. Senator Missy Irvin, because she's worried about the specialists getting cut and something else, so health savings accounts, she says she's a no. That's not three-fourths vote. So you can't say today how it's going to be done, but most people think somehow it will get done.
And I have talked to some legislative leadership in both chambers, and they actually feel that Senator Irvin's concerns can be addressed and will be addressed, and they think that there are some other members in the Senate that could be even persuaded once they see some of the facts and figures and some of the human element of what this private option can do. Do you think that they can actually turn a couple of no votes into yes votes?
It is possible. If some of the conservative action groups will stay silent, that some of the no votes could be persuaded that even if you're against the private option, even if you're against this program altogether, the fiscal session is for bookkeeping and re-upping. It's not for the policy discussion. We're getting ready to have a legislative races and a governor's race, and we'll know in the full policy session. There is some talk, you might pick up a couple of votes by persuading people that you see how when you defund things in midstream, how well that worked in Washington. Let's not do that here, particularly if say the Americans for Prosperity would not make a big deal of it. I'm not saying they wouldn't. It's just
I don't think that's going to happen.
It's possible.
Because the other political dynamic that you have at work here is that probably about the time that vote's going to take place on private option funding renewal, filing period for political office is going to open and close in the state of Arkansas.
Right. But there also, some of the legislative leaders say there are conservative things we can put in this legislation. There's some talk, either in the Joint Budget Committee or starting in the Senate, to change the bill, to change this medical services fund, to put something in there, something that sounds good, that no state money would be expended to promote this program henceforth, that only the private insurers who are benefiting, Blue Cross, QualChoice, let them promote it, get the state out of the business. If you could get some headline that would make it appear more conservative, indeed, make it more conservative, you might pick up two or three. By the way, all of this is about the Senate. In the House, I'm told that if it gets there, they may start in the Senate and then go to the House. In the House, where they got 78 votes last time, could be 80 this time.
Yeah, I don't think it goes that high, but it could be.
Well, how high do you think it goes?
I think it's 77, 78. I think a couple of them flipped, to be honest with you, because they got to sign up to run for re-election.
Well, there's that, but then, we'll see.
We'll know soon enough. But what you're talking about, too, in terms of changing that policy to garner that headline, it's going to have to be done in special language committee in joint budget or out of the budget committee there, because you're not going to find a bill introduced that's going to make some of these policy changes.
No, you don't change. You don't change the human services appropriation on the floor. You don't change. What you do is, you put some things in the bill that conservatives want, and you do it at 8 o'clock in the morning in special
when
language.
When there's no one around.
When you and I will be there, right? Right. I'll try to be there.
I'll trade days with you. How about that?
And then you concurrently make the case that look, this was only set up as a fiscal session to make sure that everything's okay so that we can do an efficient budgeting year to year. This is not the policy time. You put those two things together, maybe do something for Missy on the, but that's up to Blue Cross, whether they cut the specialty.
Right.
And then on the health savings accounts, get that waiver filed or on setting up health savings accounts within the private option population. That's sort of the way people are talking about getting it done. But even so, they're not sure just what they do, how they do it, and how it works, but that's the talk.
I sense kind of a throwback to the soft drink tax debate back in the early mid-90s, where I think you are going to have so many activists up at the Capitol representing all these different sides and trying to put this face on. I think you're going to see some conservative Tea Party activists that will be up there. I think that you'll see from the human services side, I think you're going to have to see people, kids that are disabled, elderly people that are benefiting from this private option and the program that it is, I think they're going to have to come make their argument.
Do you think we're going to see all that kind of theater in this fiscal session?
I think you may have to on this particular key vote. I think that you're going to have to. They're going to have to put that kind of political pressure on these guys.
Got to put a human face to somebody who wasn't able to afford a flu shot last year, but got it this year, and their kids got it this year. The kids would have gotten it before from our kids first, maybe. Mm-hmm. But that kind of thing. And UAMS is on the front page. You know, we can't continue to have the kind of medical center we've had because of the changing economy, and if we don't have this. Some of the Tea Party people who hang around full time with the legislature, they're going to be there. All of that is remarkable in a session that we didn't have until two or three years ago, and I still think we only have this fiscal-only session in off years because the voters didn't understand what they were doing, and yet we're going to have this kind of drama. I do think this idea that this is not the time to have this full-fledged policy debate when we're getting ready to select a governor, and we do that next year. I think there's some currency to that.
That's the strongest argument.
I think so.
Yeah,
I do.
All right, we've got about 60 seconds left here. Another quick couple of issues, because there's some other interesting funding issues that may come up in this fiscal session too. We got prison funding. You mentioned UAMS.
Right.
You've got the University of Arkansas, which seems by weeks in to have patched up some of their differences. At least
seem
there's
to
some vote of confidence from mm-hmm. the board and current leadership up there, which is a little bit of a surprise. But this could be one of the more fascinating.
Well, if we don't people don't understand how expanding Medicaid saves the state money. We are transferring to the federal government full federal funding of an expanded Medicaid population. If we undo that, if we go back to old Medicaid, we're covering a very few people, and the state has to start matching that money. The governor's people put that at $89 million a year. If you don't re-up the private option, the governor's people say, now this, the figures will be disputed, the governor's people say, this budget has an $89 million hole in it, and what are they using it for? Do you remember we went on this prison kick because the mm-hmm. parole abuse, and we had a horrible case in the streets of Little Rock, and we owe the county jails, and we need more prison money? We won't have that. In higher education, you all want any more money? So this will be a remarkable 4 or 5 days.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, speaking to John Brummett, a columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. You can find out more at talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large comes from Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
The Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We've got Lavelle White, Omar Coleman, Dave Riley and Bob Kortor, Grandpa Elliot, Cena Earhart, Pete Anderson, and a few others. And again, that's every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
Northwest Arkansas continues to experience job growth. Numbers released yesterday by the United States Bureau of Labor placed the region as fourth in the country among more than 380 metropolitan statistical areas when it comes to job growth in 2013. This morning, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Kathy Deck, the director of the University of Arkansas Center for Business and Economic Research, about the report.
When you look at Northwest Arkansas and you consider our job growth, you might say, well, we have a big percentage change because we're a small place. But in fact, when you look a little deeper into the numbers, you'll see that among the top 10 metropolitan areas, we're in fact the biggest small area with the biggest percent increase, which means, by and large, we are just really outperforming when it looks to the actual number of jobs that we're creating. So we created nearly 10,000 jobs in 2013, and that's on a base of about 220,000 jobs. So it really is impressive.
You can't be then an area of this size, add between 9,000 and 10,000 jobs in a calendar year and not feel the effects.
That's exactly right. So when you look around Northwest Arkansas, any one of us can see the economic prosperity that is being generated. And we know that we're growing. We know that we're attracting people. And people are coming here because there is, in fact, economic opportunity.
Where was the growth?
Well, the beauty of the growth that we had over the past year was that it was so very, very broad-based. In fact, we didn't have a single sector of our economy that declined in terms of employment year over year. The information sector was flat, but everybody else, from the manufacturers all the way up to our professional and business services and trade, transportation, and utilities, all of our other job-creating sectors showed growth. And when you have that kind of very broad-based employment growth, it means that you're likely to see more employment growth because of the kind of virtuous cycle that you're in.
Does nearly 10,000 new jobs in 2013 necessarily mean 5,000, 7,000, 8,000 new people in the region?
It doesn't necessarily mean that, no. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we've seen across the recovery here is that we've seen our existing population going back to school. We've seen folks who maybe have been discouraged workers coming back into the workforce. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we had to get a half a person, let's say, for every job to move into this area to take that job. It does, however, mean that we are certainly seeing our population grow. And we're really looking forward to March when the census releases its new population estimates, and we can see just how much in-migration was a factor.
Yeah, I know last night in his State of the City address, Mayor McCaslin, Bentonville mentioned that I think Bentonville's estimated population now exceeds 40,000. On one, I hate to be the dark cloud of the silver lining, but when you are growing, that does mean there will be some challenges, infrastructure, things like that.
So, in fact, when you look at the road construction, which is, of course, most obvious if you're just driving around, you can see that the investment dollars are flowing to this area to deal with some of our transportation challenges. And if you consider that both Benton and Washington County are getting about 25% of all of the state tax revenues from the quarter-cent sales tax, that we passed just generally, when there are in fact 75 counties in Arkansas, you can see that the state really wants to invest in the places where the people are and where the people are likely to be.
Of course, Benton and Washington County do have a higher percentage than some other parts of the country when it comes to people living near or in poverty. There's still the challenge to get more people with bachelor's degrees into the state. I imagine job growth like this, of course, is good, but it's not the panacea. It doesn't solve all problems.
That's exactly right. You have to look at the kind of job growth that we're having. And we are having very bimodal job growth here in Northwest Arkansas. We see a high demand for those bachelor degree plus skilled jobs in our business and professional services. In particular, you can think about the lawyers and accountants and architects that we need here in this region. But we also see a very large percentage increase in some industries like, say, leisure and hospitality or frontline retail workers. And those jobs, while they're jobs, I would never knock a job, in fact, are not as lucrative as some of the others. And so growth itself doesn't ever tell the whole story. There's no one number that tells the whole story. But you certainly would rather find yourself in a metropolitan area that is having high rates of job growth rather than those that are struggling.
Sure, a positive is better than a negative.
And that's exactly right. And so this area is going to have the challenge of lifting itself up out of some of the poverty numbers, but I think that the environment that we're talking about is much more conducive to that than others.
Moving out our scope out just a bit, Jonesboro, on the other side of the northern half of Arkansas, was the 11th best performing as far as job growth. Can a 4th and 11th MSAs help an entire state?
Well, it's fantastic to see Jonesboro doing so well. They had nearly 2,000 jobs added over the year on a base of about 52,000 jobs. So again, fantastic news for what's going on across the state. We have to see our other major metropolitan areas produce. We have to see Central Arkansas produce and Fort Smith produce jobs if we want to see the whole state rise up. And in fact, Jonesboro is still very, very challenged. It's very not Jonesboro, excuse me, Pine Bluff is very, very challenged. It's towards the bottom of the list. And when we look at the areas that are not metropolitan, and so much of Arkansas is not metropolitan, that's where the story changes quite dramatically, and we don't see anything like this kind of sparkling news that we're talking about.
I think I've asked you this before. I know I've asked you this before, but downtown Fayetteville, which is part of the Northwest Arkansas MSA, is, 65, 70 miles from downtown Fort Smith. Can there be a spillover effect from Northwest Arkansas's high rating over to the Fort Smith metro?
There is no doubt that that Northwest Arkansas, as we define it now, and the Fort Smith metro, as it is currently defined, are inextricably linked. We're very, very close together, and we see, in fact, the leadership of the two communities trying to work together to make sure that the workforce is a whole one, that whenever we find perhaps gaps in the kinds of workers that we need here in Northwest Arkansas, we might look to Fort Smith and vice versa. So it's a challenge just because we're not immediately next door. That hour is still an hour, but that's certainly not something that's insurmountable.
Finally, and this you may not be able to answer this, but the three metropolitan survey, the three MSAs that were ahead of Northwest Arkansas are Midland and Odessa, Texas, and Winchester, Virginia. Do you know anything about those three cities? Are there any commonality?
Well, if you look at Midland and Odessa, they're, of course, very, very close together in Texas. I tend to think of them as Midland and Odessa, as a matter of fact.
I think they call it that.
Exactly. And they're a very energy-based economy. It's an entirely different economic model than what we have going on here in Northwest Arkansas. Winchester, I don't know the story about Winchester, but I would love to find out what's going on here, what's going on there. I think that what we come to again and again and again here in Northwest Arkansas is really the unique position we find ourselves in with the world's largest company, with our other headquartered companies in such a small area. We're really the smallest area you can find in the United States that lives like a big place, and those job growth numbers are indicative of that.
Kathy Deck is the director of the University of Arkansas Center for Business and Economic Research. She talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this morning about the Northwest Arkansas region being ranked as fourth in the nation in job growth in 2013. One note, both Kathy Deck and Kyle mentioned the figure of 10,000 jobs created. Depending on the calculation, the number of new jobs for the Northwest Arkansas metro area ranges from 8,900 jobs to an excess of 9,000 jobs.
It is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And I'm happy because it's almost February.
It's getting there.
Okay, I just want out of the really cold weather.
I figured.
I just want out of the really cold weather. And you guys should start thinking about Valentine's, gentlemen. We'll talk more about that later. Or maybe right now.
Okay.
Because we can talk about some visual arts and museum events around the region that you might want to take your sweetheart to.
Sounds like a good date to me.
In Little Rock through March 1st, Lights, Camera, Arkansas at the Old State House Museum. And a Mark Rothko in the 1940s exhibit at the Arkansas Art Center.
Mm-hmm.
In Dallas through April 27th, Robert Smithson in Texas. And at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science, Animal Inside Out. A little worried about that one.
Yeah.
In Tulsa, at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center Gallery, Lindsay Larimore, The Quiet Side of the Peephole.
Huh.
In St. Louis through March 2nd, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, Paradox of Liberty at the History Museum in Forest Park, rather. And in Kansas City through February 9th, Impressionist France, Visions of Nation from Legray to Monet at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art.
Well, I might want to see that last one, actually.
I want to see anything that's at the Nelson Atkins.
So. Sure. It's a great museum.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
On The Next Humankind, the story of the Unabomber's brother.
I remember finally meeting with the FBI, and after a couple of days of interviews, they had showed me a map of rural Montana and asked me to point out the place on that map where my brother lived.
How David Kaczynski wrestled with his conscience.
Next time on Humankind.
Listen to Humankind, Saturdays beginning at noon on KUAF 3.
In just a few short years, Northwest Arkansas has become home to a number of local brewing companies. There's Ozark Beer Company in Rogers, Saddleback Brewery and Core Brewing in Springdale, and Fossil Cove Brewing Company in Fayetteville, among others. The craft beer scene has continued to grow thanks to companies from outside of the region beginning to distribute their products in our area. Last August, for example, Springfield-based Mother's Brewing Company introduced its beers to the region. Beginning in February, another brewer called Summit Brewing Company will expand into the Arkansas beer market. Bruce Studley is the Western Region Manager for the brewing company, which operates out of St. Paul, Minnesota.
We are truly looking forward to being part of the Arkansas beer culture that seems to be really evolving right now with recent changes in the law and various counties, changing their perception of bringing alcohol into the county in a friendly way. We're really looking forward to just being part of that culture.
Summit Brewing Company was founded in 1986 and is named for a historic road in St. Paul. With the introduction of its beer into Arkansas, Summit Beer will now be available in 18 states. When deciding where to expand, Studley says they look at markets who approach them and invite them to come take a look. For the past few years, he says consumers have written to the company about coming to Arkansas, and more recently, Summit was approached by distributors at some trade shows.
That's kind of the first step is where would somebody be interested in Summit Brewing Company? And then looking at the beer culture itself and seeing if we could find a place that Summit Brewing Company could fit into that beer culture and become part of the craft beer scene that's going across America right now.
Summit Brewing was founded by a man named Mark Stutrud, who decided to forego getting his master's in social work to start a brewery. Studley explains while Stutrud was working as a social worker at a local hospital, he was dabbling with home brewing. He says a lot of folks had started doing this since home brewing had become legal during former President Jimmy Carter's administration. It was during this time that Stutrud learned of people on the West Coast creating beers that were around before Prohibition. Summit's Western Region Manager Bruce Studley says many people who moved to America in the 1700s and 1800s had brought the skill with them to create various types of beers that disappeared during Prohibition and really didn't emerge again until the 1980s. Stutrud became interested in this and had a vision to bring these styles of beer to Minnesotans.
And so he visited with some of these guys on the West Coast who were brewing in the early 80s and got some ideas from them. He went to school to learn how to brew at Siebel in Chicago, got a degree from there, and then just traveled about looking at different breweries and how to put that together. And so he renovated an old truck parts warehouse in St. Paul in 1986, and the first keg of Summit Extra Pale Ale rolled off the line in September of that year. And since then, we really attribute our success to people who find our beer and taste it and really enjoy that and tell their friends, and they tell their friends, and we have other brewers who stop by who are starting businesses and talk to Mark how he got going, just in the same manner as he did back in 1984 and 1985 on the West Coast.
Today, Summit produces 13 varieties of premium craft beer, including 7 year-round and 5 seasonal beers. Beginning in February, the brewery's flagship beer, Extra Pale Ale, along with Saga IPA, Oatmeal Stout, and Horizon Red IPA, will be available on draft in Arkansas. Studley says Arkansans will have 45 to 60 days to find their favorite style of Summit beer on tap before bottles will be introduced into the market. He expects this to happen closer to spring, and the launch will also include their summer ale. As early as May, Arkansas will also be involved in the launch of a select number of Summit brands that will be distributed in cans. Studley says, pardon the pun, but cans have long been an untapped resource for the 28-year-old brewing company.
If we would go back 2 decades, cans were still kind of considered an inferior part of the specialty beer business. People who were producing anything other than American lagers, people considered that cans gave their beer maybe an occasional off-profile taste. But the aluminum industry and the packaging of that aluminum, which putting the beer into it and sealing it quick enough, has really come a long way in the past couple decades. And now it's actually turned into one of the better ways to enjoy your beer, you know, under many circumstances, because of the technology that's gone into aluminum and putting beer into cans.
Summit will enter the Arkansas market with the Arkansas Craft Alliance, which is made up of four core distributors: Arkansas Craft Distributors, White River Beverage Company, Three Rivers Distributing, and Three Lakes Distributing. Studley says in addition to Northwest Arkansas, there are craft beer scenes emerging in other parts of the state, including Little Rock, Hot Springs, and Pine Bluff. He says when new breweries start popping up in an area, it creates a real curiosity about craft beer.
So when a few people start doing that, I think that beer drinkers kind of unite together and want to talk more about beer and compare beers from around the countryside and city to city, state to state, and even United States to Europe. They just would get a real enjoyment out of comparing different beers from different producers.
Studley says February 3rd is the date distributors will start shipping Summit Brewing Company's beers to businesses around the state. Tanglewood Branch Beer Company in South Fayetteville plans to have Summit beer on tap that same day. For more information on the Minnesota-based brewer, you can visit summitbrewing.com. For more on craft beer in the state, you can visit facebook.com/Arkansas Craft Beer.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Up now, we have the latest installment of our monthly Three People series. Or three persons? Three people?
Three people. Yeah.
Once a month, we like to get three people together with something in common and have them kind of have a roundtable discussion.
Right.
This month, we were talking about all of the different sports that are happening, or perhaps spring sports that are getting ready to happen, and we came up with the idea of talking to a bunch of different coaches.
That's right. I spoke with Coach Vance Arnold, who is a baseball coach at Fayetteville High School. They began their baseball program in 1988, and he's been at Fayetteville High since, well, he's been there for 35 years. And then Coach Robert Paliza is the volleyball coach at the University of Arkansas. He is entering his seventh season with the Volleyball Razorbacks. And Ashley Ofinger, she's the director of Fayetteville Youth Dance Company and Art of Motion in Fayetteville. Well, I'd like to start by just, how did you decide that you wanted to become a coach? Is it something that you knew when you were perhaps playing baseball yourself in junior high and high school? Or, you know, when you were playing volleyball and dancing? Or did it just kind of seem like the next step? Coach Arnold?
Well, I think it started for me when the seventh grade band director asked me if I was going to play football and get out of the performing arts. But I've always enjoyed outdoor activities, competition. I admired many of the coaches I had when I was in youth league and stuff like that, and I wanted to be kind of a model and a mentor to young people.
Yeah, for me, it happened when I was junior and senior in high school, I was asked to coach a fifth and sixth grade team. And that was kind of the first time I kind of started kind of coaching a little bit. And it was just for a couple of tournaments. And I just kind of fell in love with it. And then from there, I kind of started coaching club. And then when I came to the United States, actually, as a college player, I got asked to coach high school. And that was kind of it. At that point, I kind of knew that was going to be my career. And I fell in love with it, and now here I am.
So leadership's kind of always been a thing for you.
Yeah, I think it has. You know, my position since I was young was to be a setter, which is a leadership position. It's kind of like the quarterback in football. And I was doing that since I was in fifth, sixth grade. So that part kind of put me in a leadership position early on in my life. You know, I never felt uncomfortable with that, and I think that's part of it.
Ashley, when did you know that you wanted to teach and direct and coach?
It took me a little bit longer. I started dancing when I was 3, and then I was on a competitive team from 8 to 18. And then from about 18 to 20, I took a little break from dance. I was still taking class, but I never thought, I kind of gave up the dream of being a professional dancer. And so I was going to school for psychology, and when I was about 20, I got asked to choreograph some solos for my old dance team back in Texas. And I fell in love with choreography and the artistry of choreographing dances. And so then I looked for a studio here, and that's when I met Hannah Pasquinzo at the Art of Motion, and I started teaching for her, and I just fell in love with it. And I finished my degree in psychology, but I knew that, you know, my heart was in teaching, and so I've been teaching ever since.
Your job's a little bit different mm-hmm. than Coach Paliza and Coach Arnold. I mean, there's a clear offense and defense, you know, with volleyball and with baseball. I mean, it's a little bit different than football, but, you know, there is. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you tell your students and your dancers?
Sure. So I'm, you know, it depends on the age, but I'm really big about creating an artist and an athlete. I think that that's really important in dance. And I think, you know, we strive for great technique and we strive for, you know, to create excellent dancers, but we also strive to create excellent people and build character in these young women. I think it's really important to inspire them to do whatever they want to do with their lives and to be the leaders of their generation, you know. And so it is difficult because it is an art and a sport at the same time, you know, and that balance is sometimes difficult as a teacher to know which to focus on at the right time.
What sort of tools do you use to motivate and inspire? What are your methods, Coach Arnold?
I talk to our athletes quite a bit. I try to give them life situations, trouble in school, attitudes, you know, tell them things that I was guilty of when I was a student or an athlete, you know, that I wasn't as responsible as I needed to be, or, you know, other coaches. Positive compliments, but let them realize, too, when they've got a bad attitude or they're being arrogant or egotistical. Those kind of things push other people away from athletes. So, you know, we try to be humble and be aware of how we're perceived in the community.
Well, you're coming off the baseball team. You were state championships.
Yes, ma'am.
Last year. Mm-hmm. So did you see a lot of – were they cocky this year, your players? And how did you ensure that they didn't walk around with a big head?
Well, we've been really blessed. We've got a great legacy at Fayetteville High School. We've got a lot of following among the community because of players who have won and played. We've won six state championships since 2002, and we've played in it seven times. So the kids kind of expect it. They've attended, some of our current players have attended former championship games, and they've seen the way our kids act, and you know, they know what's expected of them, and role models, and we as coaches try to instill in them is, you know, anything can happen at any time, so you've just got to accept what happens and move forward.
Well, Coach Paliza, you're coming off of a pretty good season as well. How do you ensure that your players
stay
humble?
Stay humble?
Yeah.
Oh, for us, it's just about understanding that what we did, you know, was good and exciting and that we feel good about it. But at the same time, understanding that that's finished, you know, that's the past. So we try to get into forward movement, you know, almost right away after the season's over.
Well, Ashley, I'm sort of picturing, you know, you primarily work with females and probably junior high school aged. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of picturing Mean Girls. A little bit, you know, I just am. So how do you make sure that doesn't happen?
Sure.
With a group of girls?
Good question. You know, there are always those bad apples every once in a while, and we've dealt with some of that. You know, it takes great communication with the parents, I think, and a common goal with the parents to, you know, really instill values in these girls. Especially with Fayetteville Youth Dance Company, I think we have a family mentality. You know, we make everything about the team more than the individual, and the team always comes first, and I think that is really important. I also started doing something this year. I had them write themselves a letter about what kind of teammate and friend and student they wanted to be this year, and what that meant to them, and told them, I said, you know, if we ever get any attitude problems or whatever, I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to say, you know, remember that letter. And what do you want to be? Who do you want to be? And it's worked really well. And I think it's kept them really motivated and focused on, you know, the type of person they want to bring to the table. Mm-hmm. So
when the going gets rough, when the going gets tough, when your season's not going so well, how do you ensure that that your players stay positive?
I think that that's always the toughest part of our job. It's always easy to be happy when you're winning. It's easy to manage when you're winning. It gets tough when things are not going well. How do you keep them positive, but still at the same time, how you hold them accountable and push them? And I think that's a fine line. That's really for coaches. I think that the toughest part of just being successful and managing those type of moments. You know, and every team is different. Every person's different. And you just try to hit the right buttons at the right time. When it all gets down to it, it's just knowing your individuals, having built relationships, and try to just keep yourself from a coaching standpoint calm enough to be able to just converse with them to see what they need and what tools you can help them with to be successful. So that's one thing I challenge myself all the time, is just to be patient and to just get to know your athletes and just really just give them the tools at those moments so that they can pull from within and find that mm-hmm. confidence and move forward.
Well, Ashley, I feel like I'm kind of talking about how your job is much different from these other two coaches, but it is. Mm-hmm. And so Coach Arnold and Coach Paliza can kind of, they can coach from the sidelines as their mm-hmm. players are playing. They can, you know, call plays or, you know, shout words of encouragement. But you're probably maybe watching from backstage. There's music going.
Right.
How do you motivate from the sidelines?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I learned maybe after my first competition season as a teacher, you know, it's different being on the other side. You know, I was a competitive kid for 10 years, so I know what that feels like to be on the competition stage. But I learned after my first year to, no matter what happens that weekend, no matter if it's their worst performance ever, it's really important to keep everything positive that day, because they have, you know, usually they'll have like 5 to 10 numbers that are competing in the same day. And if they mess up the first one and, you know, they get called on it and there's some negative energy, then they might mess up the next one. And so I've learned to just keep it all really happy and positive and wait until we get back into the studio to give constructive criticism. And we do, so at competitions, sometimes, you know, you have an hour between your dances. Sometimes you have three numbers. It just kind of depends on the competition, the schedule. And so we try to keep their energy up, but we also try to keep them focused. You know, backstage, I don't let them watch the other dances right before them because I want them to stay focused. Like, we sit in a little circle, and they stay warm, and they stay focused as a group. And we usually go around, you know, depending on the dance, we'll usually go around and talk about what the dance is about and what it means to them and what they're going, you know, what kind of emotions they're going to think about and what story they can tell through their dance, and just keep them focused and motivated. And then I usually leave them the number before and I go out to the audience, because I feel like they're old enough to kind of take some deep breaths and prepare themselves. And I think that gives them a little bit of independence, you know, to get on stage and everything.
Going along the lines of differences, Ashley works with female mm-hmm. females, and you're a male coach working with males. Mm-hmm. You're a male coach working with female players at mm-hmm. the university. Is that a challenge, and how do you overcome it if it is?
I don't think it's a challenge. Yeah. I've actually never felt it's a challenge. I really enjoyed it since I kind of really started my coaching career. I've been coaching females, so that part have been second nature. I was very lucky, you know, to have a great mom as a role model, you know, and as a strong female. And she pretty much raised me on her own and raised my brother and my sister. So I know the strength of females and how driven they are to do great things and how much they care about others. So, you know, I guess I was lucky early on to have that influence in my life. And you know, coaching females is empowering, is exciting, and they're very, very, very caring. You know, there's always, you know, I always think that the misconception that girls are girls, but our players are really, really tough females. I mean, they're tough, they're powerful, they're confident. And just seeing that in them and how driven they are to be great, it's a very powerful thing. And for me, it's not a challenge. For me, I love it.
Well, just one last question. What is the one thing that you would like me and our listeners to know about your sport, your team?
About our sport, I think it's really important. Like I said earlier, dance is, I consider it a sport and an art. And I think it's a tough balance to keep, but also an amazing balance to pursue. And I love that, and I love bringing that into young girls' lives, the athleticism and the artistry. And I think that I'm really passionate about that. You know, I care more about my kiddos' hearts and their futures as people than as dancers, and I think that that's my main focus. You know, a couple of them may be professional dancers, and I want to give them the opportunities to be able to do that, but more importantly, I want to send them out in the world to make a difference and to be the leaders of their generation.
One of the reasons I'm biased about the game of volleyball is the game of volleyball is really a true team sport. And in the sport of volleyball, you're only as good as the person next to you, okay? Because you can control the ball. It's a rebound sport. So if I'm a great attacker, I can only attack the ball, all right, if the passer passed the ball to the setter. I can only attack the ball if the setter set me the ball and set me a good set. And that's the only time I can really be successful at attacking the ball. And therefore, it immediately becomes a team sport because of those kind of circumstances. But the only way the team can move forward is if that attacker scores on that ball. And it's just really, truly an extension of each other. And I love that concept of team sport. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm drawn to volleyball so much. You're only as good as the person next to you. And again, it goes back to giving. You know, if you want to be great, you got to make sure the person next to you is great. And what are you going to do to help that person be great, and vice versa?
Well, you know, I think to echo the same thing that, you know, that we're all in team sports or we're encouraging, you know, to be successful. You know, there's examples. You see things, and I think when you actually play and are on a team that you depend on the other person and you make memories and things. Last year in the state tournament, we had absolutely fantastic pitching. And I think some of the kids thought, oh, we're going to walk through this, the tournament stuff. You know, we won't be challenged. Well, you know, we were challenged in three different games and with our best pitchers on the mound and the names and the hype and stuff. And our third baseman, who's probably the best third baseman I've ever coached, made five plays in the state tournament that allowed us to take the pressure off the pitcher and the rest of the team so they could do their job and be successful. And if we didn't have that third baseman or didn't have another player, if we played without one, then the team itself wouldn't be successful. Not one person can overcome another person's contributions. So I think to the youth in Fayetteville and the community in the area that team sports depend on more than one person.
Joining me for our three people series were Coach Vance Arnold, baseball coach at Fayetteville High School, Coach Robert Paliza, volleyball coach at the University of Arkansas, and Ashley Ofinger, director of the Fayetteville Youth Dance Company and Art of Motion. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs through a collective voice.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Huntington.
Huntington. Why Huntington?
Well, Huntington is just south of Greenwood. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow, on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, we will have a story about Huntington.
Okay, well, looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
You can tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with her co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Wednesday.